The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. Donald Trump's lewd talk on that video continues to impact the presidential race. The first poll that came out after the tape's release was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll on Monday. It showed Hillary Clinton pulling ahead by 11 percentage points. That's her biggest lead over Donald Trump since this campaign began. Now, that's a small poll, and it's only one poll, and it doesn't take Sunday's debate into account. But there's no way it's good for Donald Trump. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the language that Donald Trump used in that video and how men, when they're alone, often speak in ways that excludes and, in this case, victimizes women. But meanwhile, civics and government classes in schools all across America are following this election, and teachers find themselves standing in front of students who are consuming an election with candidates unlike any they ever remember seeing before. Sometimes there are students who feel they're the target of anti-immigrant or anti-Muslim rhetoric. It's also a safe bet that roughly half of all classes are girls who are watching the race right alongside boys who are consuming the campaign too. It's a teaching challenge. We spoke with two educators before school started this morning. John Dixon is a government teacher at Monomoy Regional High School in Harwich, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. He's been a teacher for about 25 years now. And Joy Bach, an eighth grade social studies teacher in the Groveport Madison School District in Columbus, Ohio.
Hello.
John Dixon, you have high school students. How have you been teaching this election so far?
Well, we've been teaching this election like we teach every election, in terms of trying to help the students have context to the election and helping them understand both sides of a campaign and people who choose on either side of an election.
Joy Bach, you've got younger students who probably understand an election like this on a different level than the older kids.
They do. They are very much different. You know, it's not always put into perspective to them. Voting seems so far down the road. So to really engage them and put it into perspective is always a challenge.
All right. So that all sounds pretty familiar to me. John Dixon, you said you make an effort to teach both sides to these students. But then right there, I start to kind of raise an eyebrow, because so much about this election, and I've covered a lot of them, is different, really different from any past election. Now, you took your students to a Trump rally earlier this year, and I want to start there because there's so much about the language and the strategy of this election that the country hasn't seen in a long time, a very long time.
Yes. So I took a group of students to the Iowa caucuses and attended 12 rallies while we were there, candidates of both parties. And we did get a chance to attend a Trump rally. And it happened to be the Trump rally where he encouraged his the audience to attack any protester and that he would pay their legal costs. So we did have a front row seat at some of the harsh elements of this campaign. But in terms of giving context, to understand the campaign, for example, we talk about the 1994 election, the restriction of the federal government that was promised then, and then in some people's minds was betrayed by the Bush administration, and how this resentment helped lay the groundwork for the Tea Party movement and today the Trump campaign.
So there's a great deal of context there, frankly, that I don't see in a lot of media reporting about the phenomena that led to the Trump campaign in the first place.
I think that's, part of the nature of being a social studies teacher in middle or high school is that we, first of all, have the luxury of time in terms of having students all year. And that's certainly part of our job to help them understand what's going on today in relation to what's happened before.
Joy Bach, we can't get around in this election some of the language that's been spoken, not only in tapes that we've seen in the last few days that are completely inappropriate, I would take it, for your students, but also language about immigrants, language about religious groups and Muslims. Can you give me a sense of how your younger students process what they see on the news and what they take to class?
They process a lot of it right at heart. I mean, it touches them deeply. I have a young girl whose family has immigrated from Peru. She broke my heart one day. She's 14 years old, scared to death, because her parents have told her if Trump wins, they're going to need to leave to be safe. And so now that's said in the middle of my classroom with 30 other students sitting around looking like, is she really not going to be safe? And so it has had a greater impact on them, I think, during this election than any other election. They haven't heard this type of harsh tone. The things we in eighth grade are still telling them, be kind to one another, don't, you know, make fun of others. And they're seeing it now done by a level of person that they were told that, you know, you should have the utmost respect for. So it is very different and has made for difficult conversations.
And how do the students themselves react? I mean, they know that there's a dissonance here. They know what the right thing is to do. You've told them, and their parents tell them to treat others with respect and don't make fun of other people or exclude them. They see a presidential campaign that is often the opposite of that. Do they voice and vocalize how confusing that can be?
They do vocalize how confusing it can be. Yesterday was Columbus Day. Many students had off. We of course, did not. We had school. And, you know, first words out of their mouth before I could, you know, was good morning for me. But out of their mouth was, did you see the tapes this weekend? And I'm like, no. Please don't repeat any of the words. But, you know, it was top of their priority. So regardless of the lesson I had planned, that kind of took precedent for the moment to connect to what's going on and to tie it into the Electoral College conversation we were getting ready to have. So it has really impacted their lives. I see them paying much closer attention this election. Eighth graders are kind of sometimes hard to engage into an election. 4 years down the road to vote seems so far off to them, but this has really taken their attention.
John Dixon, you talked a little bit earlier about how you teach the background and the political road to how we got to this point, particularly as it stands now in the Republican Party. That's the big transition going on at the moment in American politics. How do you teach the birther phenomenon to your students, and how do they react to it?
It's a good example. I mean, it's in many ways it's reprehensible, and there's no way to teach it without emphasizing the counterfactual nature of the argument. But one of the things we point out is that the seed is a law in Hawaii that makes birth certificates not public record. So that lack of public record is what allows the beginnings of a conspiracy to come about. But it turns out we've been reading the Constitution the last week, and one thing we discovered or we pointed out is that even if the president wasn't born in the United States, as long as he was born a citizen, he's eligible to be president. So regardless of where he was born, unless people argue that his mother wasn't his mother, he's eligible to be president.
And do you get into some of the darker motivations or some of the more insidious implications of the birther phenomenon that go back to 2011? I mean, really, for adults, behind all this is an idea that the first black president can't possibly be a real American and can't be one of us.
Absolutely. We do talk about racism. It's a very important part of our class and our discussion to talk about racism, to talk about the bias that was behind many people's motivations in an issue like the birther phenomena. And I think events like Colin Kaepernick's protest and the many athletes and celebrities that have responded to that gives us a great window to talk about race in the modern context.
So, Joy Bach, let's word associate just for a moment if we can, because I'm so interested in how your eighth grade students kind of process the characters in this election. If I were to sort of open it up to impressions, one word answers with your kids and say Hillary Clinton, what would be some of the most likely answers I would get back?
They think she's nicer. She seems organized to them. She seems to have answers to them as compared to, I'll skip to the other side, Trump, where they seem to think he's angry, he's mean, he's, you know, not kind to others, he makes enemies, he's degrading. It's becoming in my classroom a very good-bad situation. But in the eighth grade mindset, that's often how they relate things, good and bad, and, you know, not to the level of high school students yet.
Do they associate dishonesty with Hillary Clinton in the way that so many voters seem to?
You know what, the students don't really see the dishonesty that the adult voters seem to be holding on to. They realize she made a mistake, but they're so tech savvy and they use their phones and things every day of their life. They understand how mistakes can be made with technology, and they don't see it as a big deal and as being dishonest as the adults of the country do.
Now, John Dixon, how long have you been teaching?
This is my 20th year in this district.
Well, that would mean if I'm subtracting 20 that you started teaching right around 1996. I mean, you were teaching back in 1998 then, when President Bill Clinton had a major confrontation with Republicans over his own sexual behavior, and it's the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Yes, that actually was my first year in this district. Was the year of the of that scandal and the later trial, and it was certainly a challenge. And that was my first exercise in speaking in euphemisms in class, and having to discuss what was in the news and being sensitive to students' sensibilities as far as what we can and can't discuss in class.
I'm going to predict, John Dixon, that you're going to have another exercise in euphemism in class today when the students come back.
That is true.
How's that going to work?
The students certainly, they will understand what has happened probably pretty thoroughly. And I think what they'll want is a chance to have some space to react to it and to deconstruct it. And that, I think, is going to be our exercise for the day.
John Dixon, government teacher at Monomoy Regional High School in Harwich, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Joy Bach, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Joy Bach is an 8th grade social studies teacher at Groveport Madison School in the swing state of Ohio. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and this is the part of the show where we really want to hear from you. You know, this election, particularly the Trump phenomenon, has been a challenge for news media outlets and how they cover politics. How to fit the need for fairness into a campaign where simply saying both sides do it doesn't come close to accurately describing the candidates or the type of politics that they're running on. And we heard earlier that teachers are dealing with some of those same questions. Parents are also struggling with how to talk about this election in a year where nothing seems off limits.
This is Kathy from St. Petersburg, Florida. My daughter is 6 and saw an ad about Trump and how he talks about women. I didn't realize how much the words stick with our children. Someone who is trying to become the leader of the free world cannot say that words don't mean anything. His words and his position mean everything.
We heard a lot from you about how you are talking with your kids about the election or how they're learning about it in school. And a lot of you said it's difficult in this cycle.
This is Daniel from Portland. Honestly, this is not the kind of election you can discuss easily with kids unless they're old enough to start talking about racism, misogyny, protecting themselves from sexual predators if they're girls, or what you're not allowed to do if you're a male.
We got this from Rye, New York. Sadly, I could not let my kids watch the debate because I don't want to have to explain groping and sexual assault to an 8-year-old. Thank you, Donald Trump, for lowering the bar even further. And many of you said you grappled with explaining the unpopularity of both candidates.
I'm Zach Rouse in Eureka, California. I'm very open with my teenager about how this election is essentially a choice between 1984 and Back to the Future 2. The prior, an exquisite tragedy, the latter, a farce. She is very astute, and the next election is her first. She should be well-versed by that time, although it's hard to imagine any real change happening if the last 30 years is any indicator. Ugh.
Hey, this is Wayne calling from Detroit. I'm at a loss here. The fact that there's two people that are so unpopular running in this election is just a statement as to how rigged our political process is. And that's the message I'm instilling in both my sons. Look for the third-party alternative.
We got this from Dallas, Texas. We tell our oldest 3 that neither candidate should be trusted to run a program at a rec center, let alone run a country like the United States. Both candidates are loathsome choices, but Hillary is so much more so. We tell them that the media will be utterly to blame for her election, and there are a few things as deplorable as the news media because their purpose is solely bent on promoting that which is unholy.
This is James from Anchorage, Alaska. My kids are 9 and 7. They want to know what happens if no one gets elected. I say we all rejoice.
And some of you talked about the difficulties of explaining Trump's inflammatory language about minorities.
I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. My older son is terrified about the election because he is black. And all he hears from the Trump side is racism. During the debate last night, he noticed the repeated, quote, inner city comments. He's 11. My younger son's 8 and he's white. We live in a magnet area for refugees and it's a safe, small city with very inclusive. The people Trump talks about are his friends and his classmates. really confused about the vilification of them.
And we got this from South Carolina. Our 7-year-old adopted Chinese daughter is afraid Donald Trump would send her back to China if he became president. She thinks, and I quote, Trump is a butthead. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can head to facebook.com/thetakeaway to continue this conversation with us.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Samsung announced yesterday that it would stop producing their Galaxy Note 7 phone, which has been plagued by overheated and sometimes exploding batteries. The company also said to people who own that Galaxy Note 7, if you've got one, turn it off. Well, that's a hard thing for a company to have to tell its customers. And today, Samsung has more explaining to do to 8 justices of the Supreme Court when its patent design case against Apple comes up on the docket. The dispute is over the design of Samsung's Galaxy phones, which Apple says Samsung basically copied. Now, that might sound strange today when almost all smartphones look like a rectangle with rounded edges and a black screen. But back in 2007, that wasn't the case.
But what we're going to do is get rid of all these buttons and just make a giant screen. A giant screen. And boy, have we patented it.
Well, after Steve Jobs said that, a jury did find that Samsung did infringe on 3 of Apple's phone design patents. But what the Supreme Court has to decide is the penalty for that. Samsung was ordered to pay Apple all of the profits it earned from those phones, $400 million. And Samsung says that's not fair. Christine Haight Farley is professor of law at American University, where she specializes in intellectual property law.
What Samsung is arguing is that that verdict is ridiculous because it's compensating Apple for the total profits that Samsung made in 11 of their phones when the infringement found below was only to very discrete aspects of the design. So Samsung is arguing that at best, they should be held liable for something like $3.9 million. Because that would account for the profits they made by copying the designs.
So that means that one of the issues that's really coming up here from Samsung's point of view is like, hey, we didn't copy the way the phone works or what makes it so fast or makes the screen so bright. Maybe the edges are contoured in this way or the curves, the things that maybe make it look like an iPhone, and that's not worth $400 million.
That's exactly what they're saying. Their brief really and their arguments really belittle the role that design plays in these products. And they said, you know, here we have a product that has thousands upon thousands of patents involved, and people buy these phones because of the technology. They want certain functional aspects in a phone that we've provided them, that we are the innovators that are responsible for that function, and they're not buying them because of the rounded corners or the silver bezel that goes around the edge. They're buying it for how it works. And so, you know, we shouldn't have to turn over our profits from these 11 phones.
And Apple says, look, you totally copied our look, and the look is iconic, and that's worth a lot of money.
They use the words assiduously copied over and over again.
Assiduously copied.
So, yes, Apple has a totally different take, not surprisingly. And that is, and again, a phrase that they repeat again and again is the design sells the product. And they tout the importance of the iPhone design and what a role it played in the industry and how important it is to consumers. And in part, they argue that, you know, whether you like the rule or not, it's the law. The law is total profits of the article of manufacture. In this case, the article of manufacture, Apple says, is the phone.
Well, let's talk about that law for a second, because we're talking about premier high-tech consumer products here. The law at the base of all this, as I understand it, is like 130 years old.
Yes, all of patent law is quite old. So it is a fact that these kind of concepts of patent law are quite ancient. They're not updated with technology, but they more or less work. This particular case that's being argued at the Supreme Court today is about design patents, not utility patents. This particular aspect of the law has generally been in place for over 100 years. The specific language we have today has been in the Act since the 1940s. And this is the first, obviously, Supreme Court challenge of that law. In fact, the Supreme Court hasn't heard a case on design patents in over 100 years. So part of the argument that Samsung is making is that this outdated law does not fit today's marketplace. This doesn't account for the kinds of products at issue here, a smartphone. And they talk about, you know, old cases that involved the design of Oriental carpets, where possibly the design sold the product. Here we have, you know, a plastic shell around really sophisticated technology. And if you are selling and producing really sophisticated technology that consumers want to buy, you shouldn't have to turn over your total profits because you copied, you know, aspects of this plastic shell. So, I'm paraphrasing Samsung's argument. That's obviously an extreme view of the case.
So it really makes you wonder, Christine Haight Farley, how much experience the justices themselves will have with these smartphones, you know, whether they're going to retire to chambers to tinker around with a bunch of Samsung phones and iPhones to kind of get a feel for it, or they might have to rely on the younger clerks to weigh in before they vote on this case and write the briefs.
Well, you know, in a way, I think this is a case, this is a patent case, which everybody will find accessible, right? We're all familiar with the aspects of the design that iPhone is claiming to have patented. So I don't know that they'll be confused by that. I think the justices are going to be interested in to what extent Samsung is asking them to change the law as written. The Court of Appeals that decided the case that's now on appeal to the Supreme Court held that the law as written precludes us from finding in Samsung's favor. The law states total profits very clearly. But then the Court of Appeals said, even though that may not make sense in the modern world. So there the court is criticizing the law, but, you know, saying we are nonetheless bound by it. I think what Samsung is arguing is for the Supreme Court to understand how much the law doesn't work today and to find a way to apply the current law in a way that wouldn't have them be awarded total profits.
And there are entire industries that are based on copying. I mean, when one hot new car comes out, you get six more cars that look almost exactly like it.
And that's a great example. So in a car, you may have, you know, the shape of the windshield is subject to a design patent. The shape of the bumper is subject to another design patent. You know, how the window is framed might be subject to another design patent. So I think companies are going to pay much more attention to these patents. They're going to have to design around them if they don't want to be sued. And I think that if this rule stands, I think we're going to see more litigation about these design patents, that companies are going to try to invalidate them because they will interfere with a kind of evolution of design in a way that hadn't been anticipated.
It started with a case about Oriental carpets 100 years ago, and today these cases on design patents are decidedly more high-tech and higher stakes. Christine Haight Farley, professor of law at American University, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Russia and its influence continue to weave their way into the presidential election. Yesterday at a campaign rally, Donald Trump read to the crowd a news report with alleged new revelations about Benghazi. It had been published in a Kremlin-owned online news service. And last week, the Obama administration officially blamed the Russian government for leaking emails from the Democratic National Committee. The statement came from intelligence and homeland security agencies here in the U.S., and it states that the hack likely originated from servers operated by a Russian company. Then Secretary of State John Kerry called for a war crimes investigation over attacks on civilians in Syria by the Russian and Syrian governments. Russian officials responded, saying the statements were, quote, unacceptable judgments and propaganda. Maria Snegovaya is a columnist at Russian business daily Vedomosti. She says the timing of these announcements was politically motivated.
So I think there are three reasons why the U.S. Government would choose to announce this right now. This announcement is indeed quite unprecedented. The first would be that, in my opinion, President Obama does try to help a little bit his Democratic partner, Hillary Clinton, in these elections. We know that Trump actually speaks very favorably and nicely about President Putin. That's not the case on the Democratic side. The other reason would be the fact that the U.S. is, in fact, quite annoyed by the fact that the Russian government has been really meddling into the U.S. elections this time. And ultimately, you know, White House doesn't have a lot of time left. So now, finally, they can afford these harsh statements about Russia because they know they wouldn't have to follow through.
So part of the timing here, as you said, the first thing you said is blaming this on Russian hacks helps immunize Hillary Clinton from the leaks that show her emails and show her conversations that look bad for her. It's sort of political cover there.
Definitely, because it's clear that the White House is trying to position Trump as he's in favor of Putin. And in fact, Trump does a lot to do that too, right?
Is there any actual consequence to an announcement like this from U.S. officials? Are there any sanctions involved, or does it obligate the president or intelligence agencies to take any particular action, or is it simply a rhetorical exercise?
So this announcement is quite unprecedented, so we don't really know what is going to happen next. Russia is quite irritated at this point, and I actually just have been to D.C. on Thursday. And I would say the sanctions are not coming in the near future. But the next administration, especially if it's Hillary, is likely to follow up in the sense that the relationships will worsen and sanctions are also possibly will be introduced.
So we mentioned also that Secretary of State John Kerry called for an investigation into Russia's behavior in Syria and the Syrian government as well. Is a type of international criminal court investigation that Kerry is calling for likely to happen? And if so, how would the Russians respond?
I would not expect that to happen in the near future because the administration has too many other things going on. But if Hillary becomes the next president, it's possible. And Russia is definitely going to be more annoyed. You know, Putin is already quite annoyed by the recent investigation regarding the MH17 flight and his recent very harsh statements against the United States in this breaking with their accords regarding the nuclear collaboration and other things have a lot to do with the MH17 investigation.
We are used to a U.S.-Russian relationship that is multifactorial, complicated, flare-ups in one area, Syria or hacking, cooperation in other areas like nuclear proliferation or ISIS. Overall, though, is the relationship now really at a low point, or are these just flare-ups?
You know, typically the new administration comes with some ideas of reset with Russia, and they tend to follow and the hotel to collapse by the end of the administration. That's nothing new in this sense. But it is true that Vladimir Putin's geopolitical views and worldview in general is really opposite from the one by the U.S. administration. So unfortunately, I would not expect any improvement in the near future.
Maria Snegovaya is a columnist at Russian business daily Vedomosti. Over the weekend, Houthi rebels in Yemen launched two missiles at a U.S. Navy destroyer off the coast near rebel territory. That incident came a day after Saudi airstrikes hit a funeral hall in the Yemeni city of Sana'a, killing more than 100 people and injuring hundreds. Among the dead was the mayor of Sana'a, who supported peace talks with the exiled government. It was the single deadliest attack in Yemen since that civil war began in 2014. Meanwhile, there is already growing opposition in Washington to billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. The United States now says it's launching an immediate review of its support for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. The civil war against the Shiite rebels in Yemen has been raging for more than 18 months and has killed more than 10,000 people. The latest attack makes peace talks less likely, even as Yemen sinks toward a humanitarian crisis. Afra Nasser is an independent Yemeni journalist and blogger focusing on human rights. Afra, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What reactions are you hearing from family and friends to the latest airstrike in Yemen?
It's a combination of anger, pain, outrage, fury over not only the bloodshed and the crime that was committed, but also in the indifference of the international community in allowing this to happen.
So what are the concerns now in the immediate sense for an escalation on the ground? After the attack that we've mentioned on the funeral, there have been missiles fired into Saudi Arabian territory, missiles fired apparently at a U.S. warship off the coast, and there seems to be a great risk of escalation now.
That's true. And the very alarming indicator of the road of this war, where it's heading to, is really if the Iranis will intervene militarily. And that could have very catastrophic implication to the war in Yemen that will result in another Syria, most probably, if there is not a real stand from the international community, meaning in a specific, if the UK and the US did not push their Saudi ally or they did not rethink their support to the Saudi-led coalition. If that is not happening, I'm sure we're going into a very, very bloody direction in the war.
Afra Nasser, you just mentioned the prospect of another Syria in Yemen. And if that's true, that prospect is utterly terrifying.
Absolutely. And the only way out of that kind of scenario is really for the Yemeni politicians to really prioritize the national interest, because the starting foundation or the trigger of this war is a civil war inside the country, where different Yemeni politicians, starting from the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh to the rebel groups, the Houthis, and the Yemeni president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi and his government, everyone was they're trying to enforce their power in the country, and that's what really triggered the civil war inside Yemen. So the only way out is for those politicians really to prioritize the national interest.
And so what do you think is the most important thing from your point of view for the United States to do right now? Of course, the U.S. backs Saudi Arabia in its role in this proxy war, but if the United States leans on its ally to back off and there's still a civil war raging within the country, that doesn't get the leaders in Yemen, as you say, necessarily closer to a settlement that can end the war.
Yeah, like the U.S. role is very, very crucial. And for the next president, I'm sure the priority will be definitely Syria or, you know, the national or domestic affairs. But Yemen will not definitely be in their agenda. So it's very, very crucial to find some kind of solution right now with Obama administration, to find a way where the Washington administration can really pressure their ally, Saudi Arabia, in trying to stop the violence. Because right now, even in this latest incident, the attack on the funeral hall, there are evidence from people on the ground taking pictures of some of the remnants of the weapon used that was very clear that it was made by the U.S. So it's very, very crucial that the U.S. take more concrete stand in the violence in Yemen.
And at the same time, it seems that the Houthis' attempt to fire missiles at a U.S. Navy warship off the coast is an attempt to draw the United States further into conflict. It seems like the aim there is to go in the opposite direction of what you're describing.
Absolutely. And the Houthis will definitely say that this is part of like a self-defense strategy that they're having. But this is only feeding into the continuation of the violence.
Have you seen any indication that the United States shares this sense of urgency that you share to try to de-escalate this conflict, especially before a change in administration in the United States takes place?
Yeah, human rights organization trying to pressure the Congress, the U.S. officials, government officials to really reconsider the support they're giving to Saudi Arabia. The more there is pressure, the more there are question marks raising by some American officials in the kind of support that they're giving to Saudi Arabia. For instance, the latest evidence of this, there were leaked documents from Reuters showing like a correspondence between some human rights organizations and some American officials where they were explaining how by under the international law, the U.S. could be taking part in the war in Yemen by allowing the Saudi Arabia targeting indiscriminately and not differentiating between civilians or a military target. What kind of explanation that the American officials give that the Houthis are not a group that are wearing some kind of uniform clothes where it's very easy to identify them and really to target them among the masses. They are part of the social fabric in Yemen, and it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, really, to differentiate between them and the other civilians. So from this kind of explanation, some of the American officials find it extremely difficult to really minimize the civilian casualties. And that should make the U.S. government really rethinking the kind of role that they are having in the war in Yemen.
Afra Nasser is an independent Yemeni journalist and blogger focusing on human rights who spoke with me from Sweden. Afra Nasser, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Donald Trump's comments about possibly sexually assaulting a woman on an Access Hollywood videotape continues to rock the presidential race. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he'll no longer defend Trump nor campaign with him, though he didn't take away his endorsement. Trump's surrogates, including Mike Pence, were still dealing with the comments on the campaign trail yesterday. Pence said he believes in the grace of forgiveness. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani was somewhat more gleeful when he talked to a Trump crowd in Pennsylvania yesterday.
I can't say the word because I have to be nice. I might say it back in the locker room.
Meanwhile, thousands and thousands of women, mostly on the internet, have been coming forward with their own stories about experiencing the type of abuse Donald Trump was talking about in his conversation with two other men on the tape. The recorded conversation was shocking to a lot of people, but it's nothing new to Deborah Cameron. She's a linguist at the University of Oxford, and she's been studying the roots and consequences of so-called locker room talk for years. She joins me now. Deborah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Donald Trump's language, along with Billy Bush in the Access Hollywood videos, have been widely reported and deconstructed. And though Donald Trump apologized, he attributed the conversation to locker room banter. Now, that struck a chord with a lot of people, athletes, many of whom have said that their actual locker rooms are nothing like this. Other men have said, yes, we talk about sex when women aren't around, but it's not abusive or misogynistic. So the locker room here obviously is a metaphor. What is the locker room that Donald Trump is using in his excuse?
It is a metaphor, as you say, and I think this is a metaphorical all-male space in which the real purpose is for men to bond with each other. And one of the ways in which they do it, though not the only one, is to talk about women, their other, in an objectifying and sometimes dehumanizing way. And I think it is a fairly common social ritual among men, though that's not to say that it takes place in every locker room. And it has brought forth, you know, a lot of revelations. Women have gone on record saying, yes, the things they talked about do happen. They happened to me. They happened to me when I was 9 in a supermarket aisle. They happened to me when I was 12 on the bus in the swimming pool. You know, I think that has come as a revelation to some people.
Professor, I spend a lot of time in politics. Uh-huh. And one of the aspects of this conversation for me was the political disavowals that followed. I've been struck by the number of male politicians who've prefaced their condemnations of Donald Trump. They're disgusted because they have wives and daughters and they can't stand to hear this stuff. As though people who don't have wives and daughters don't know inherently that it was wrong, or that having a wife or a daughter is the only reason to condemn this sort of language.
Yes, the name for that's sometimes given to that is benevolent sexism. It's very patronizing. It's we're protecting the honor of our women. And heaven knows in the history of America that has been used as the excuse for some dreadful things on which the women hadn't been consulted. But it seems to me that yes, that's sort of very revealing, because I think we know that men may compartmentalize, that there are women who are off limits and who they're disgusted on behalf of, and there are women that they would banter about. You know, if those guys have been in fraternal orders, in fraternities at college, or, you know, business associations, or in this case, sort of political caucuses, I believe they've probably been in those kinds of conversations themselves, obviously not about their sisters and mothers and daughters and so forth. Trump's a bit of an outlier there, but they have done it. So, you know, I find it rings pretty hollow, that kind of condemnation.
Deborah Cameron, is there evidence about how this type of language directly affects behavior? We're talking about the private conversations and sort of the social ordering that goes on among men. Does this type of abusive language have a direct connection to abusive action?
It has a direct connection, I think, or maybe direct is the wrong word, but it certainly is a contributory factor in two kinds of things that are harmful in real life. One is the exclusion of women from social networks in things like professions or workplaces and so forth. This kind of talk is exclusionary. If it's done in front of women, it embarrasses and humiliates them. If it's done behind their backs to bond the men, it means that they can't really participate in equal terms. And this is why a number of businesses have sort of taken steps to try and stop, for instance, bankers meeting their clients in strip clubs and that kind of thing. But the other thing is to do with actual sexual abuse and violence. And I think it's kind of interesting to me that the anthropologist Peggy Reeve-Sande at Penn University, who has done a lot of work on campus rape and the gang rapes that occasionally go on, come to light in fraternities or sports teams, she finds that engagement in this kind of sexualized banter is one of the predisposing features, you know, along with heavy use of alcohol and heavy use of pornography, that seems to predispose a culture to be what she calls rape prone. You know, so it encourages a mindset, an attitude to women as things, as, you know, objects without feelings, not at all like men who are talking about them. It encourages both male bonding and that attitude to women. And that is a very toxic combination, because it means that in order to feel closer to each other and prove their manhood, men will do things, mistreat, you know, the group of people, women, that they have dehumanized in their talk. So that does seem to be a connection.
Well, it seems to me, Deborah Cameron, that you and I are having this conversation and the world is having this conversation on the cusp of a point where a woman may take the position of ultimate authority.
That's true. But what we're talking about here is a kind of private and informal culture that I think will be changed mainly by peer pressure. I mean, I've studied a lot of banter. You know, I wrote about the Trump thing because I was familiar with the genre from having looked at a lot of other data from much less famous people. And I always, when I talk about it, get messages from men who say, and have done this time as well, I'm deeply uncomfortable with this. But many of them will also say, yeah, but I do let it go, or I do even join in with it, because everybody wants to be part of the group. You don't want to be the wuss, the person whose own masculinity is in question, the person who's not, you know, hasn't got your friends' backs and that kind of thing. And I think if anything is going to change here, it really has to be coming from men having the courage to sort of say, I'm uncomfortable with this. Let's not talk this way. I'm not going to talk this way. I'm not going to condone you talking this way. There has to be peer pressure, the same way I think there has been, you know, not as much as there should be perhaps, but attitudes have over time changed to racist talk or, you know, really homophobic talk. There's a better attitude to that than there used to be, I think. And this thing about sexualizing women, talking about them as, you know, it, and as words that I'm not allowed to say on the radio, men have got to stand up and challenge other men.
Deborah Cameron, thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you.
Professor Deborah Cameron is a linguist at the University of Oxford. She's author of The Myth of Mars and Venus: Do Men and Women Really Speak Different Languages? Well, here's something to take with you today. Our next home might be just 4.3 light years away. If only we could get a close-up view of Earth-like planets that, as we've said on the show, might be orbiting Alpha Centauri. There's a new mission afoot. It's called Project Blue. The aim is to build a small telescope, put it in orbit by 2019 to search for Earth-like planets. It's being led by Mission Centaur, which is a nonprofit searching for planets around Alpha Centauri. You know, in the future, if the election doesn't go your way, You might have an alternative to saying you're going to move to Canada. Think about it. Follow me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.